Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
He kōna e ipurangi tēnei nā te reo irirangi o Aotearoa.
I remember the drive from Upper Hutt over there, and my biggest fear the whole time was that Stephen was going to come to this realisation of what he had done and clam up.
Hi, I'm Jesse Mulligan, and this is Crimes NZ. In this episode, we're looking into the case of Coral Ellen Burrows. She was reported missing on September 9th, 2003. She was just 6 years old. And former detective John Galter worked on the case, which was known as Operation Reef.
I remember very clearly heading off to work for a normal day in Wellington at the police station and being home about an hour later and throwing some clothes in the bag and 3 hours later in the Wairarapa. So that day certainly changed direction quite quickly, but that's par for the course.
Was that on the day that she was reported missing?
Yes, it was. So I think I started, was meant to start work at 3, and I think by 6 o'clock I was in the Wairarapa. So, yeah, we got over there pretty smartly.
Is that normal for police from Wellington to be deployed into the Wairarapa?
Yeah, I mean, it's all about circumstances, and I think that being a young child, missing from the school, and there's probably a few things that popped up which, you know, on the face of it, it looked a bit strange. So, yeah, not that unusual, really, for police to be deployed from other areas to help out.
What did you have to go on when you got there?
Well, not much, really. I mean, we sort of jumped in a car, me and a couple of others, and shot over the hill to find out that, you know, basically that was a missing person, that Coral, sort of later in the day, had been found that she hadn't gone to school. And, of course, the alarm bell started going because that's abnormal for a start, but, you know, kids can go missing. Really, that was all. It was really about just going over there, talking to the local police that had some involvement with the early stages of the inquiry and just trying to find out what had happened.
It's funny, the guy who was arrested, Stephen Williams, he was the one who had allegedly dropped her off at school, so it seems like sort of obvious that he would be the man to look at. Maybe let's start with your first encounter with him.
Yeah, well, you know, like all these inquiries, you know, you have to be very careful that you don't get the tunnel vision on early on in the piece. And we've all got perceptions and biases and, you know, all these things affect how you view things. So you have to be very aware not to go and hone in on the first thing that feels right.
Mm-hmm.
However, it's, you know, of course, the last person to see anyone that is missing or deceased is absolutely going to be a person of interest from very early on in the proceedings. So, yeah, there was no doubt that Stephen was in the mix, but definitely not exclusionary to anyone else. Not at that stage anyway, that's for sure.
What sort of guy was he?
Well, you know, it was interesting. I'd spoken to some of the local police officers at the time because being a small area, they had had dealings with Stephen, and, you know, there was mixed views, but generally he wasn't a really nice guy, that's for sure.
He wasn't?
No, but what you do know is that over the years I've learnt that you've got to really find these things out for yourself pretty quickly because everyone has a different experience depending on what day of the week they dealt with an individual. So I certainly knew that he was a person who'd had a bit of criminal history and...
What sort of stuff?
I can't remember exactly, of course. There's a lot of convictions in there and for violence and drugs and so forth. So, you know, my first impression was he was probably not a very nice guy. But of course, I did get to meet him later on that day. And when I did meet Stephen, he was walking down the road back towards his house, and it was about I think it was about 7 or 8 at night. And he was bizarrely quite amicable, helpful, which was a total turnaround from how the detectives that had dealt with him early on had said that he was earlier in the day. So that was a bit strange for a starter.
Yeah.
So tell me about the investigation. What did you do over the next few days?
Well, my role really was to deal with Stephen as the stepfather and the last person who saw him. And the rest of the inquiry was starting to build up as well. So I wanted to speak to him, of course, and so I got that opportunity around 6 or 7 at night. After speaking with him for a while, I arranged to talk with him the following morning, just to find out what he'd been doing, his side of the story, just to start digging around into the background, really, considering we're on day one. So I really wanted to get stuck into that. So, yeah, we left it at that. The relationship was good with him. I was quite confident that I was going to go and see him the next morning.
So tell me about that.
Yeah, so, well, obviously I had a group that I was working with or a partner, and we went back home and worked out what we'd want to do for the next day. And, of course, we went round there in the morning, around 7 or 8 in the morning, to find that Stephen had been whisked away in an ambulance to Masterton. He'd had some form of breakdown or not quite sure what, but he wasn't very well anyway. So he had been taken away to the hospital, so that was a bit of a curveball. And we really had to sort of think, what are we going to do now? So away we went up to Masterton to sort of find out how he was faring and see if we could get to speak to him at a later time when he'd had some medical attention and so forth.
Because he went back to jail at some point as well, didn't he?
Yes, he did, yeah. So it was this early stage was quite weird how it all occurred. So eventually, with Stephen, we later on that day he was released from hospital and he was fine, and we had a word to him and took him back to Featherston, back down from Masterton to Featherston Police Station, and we got DNA or some blood samples for DNA purposes, and everything was looking pretty good, but it was quite late in the day, so we had a quick word with Stephen, and then we found out that he had an arrest warrant from a past matter that hadn't been dealt with. So on that basis, of course, we had to keep him in custody because, if I can remember clearly, it was a bench warrant, so he was going to have to appear again and be sentenced on another matter. So it was another curveball. So he ended up going back to Marston that night and be kept in the cells to appear in court the next morning on that warrant. So, yeah, that was the early stages of the inquiry. So it was interesting times. A lot of trips back and forward from Featherston to Masterton, that's for sure.
Meanwhile, I presume that there's a big search going on for Coral Allen Burrows, isn't it?
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, so alongside that little story with, in my part of it, with Stephen, of course, there's a big inquiry starting to be, you know, wound up with searches and all the specific areas that you would have for any large inquiry, general inquiries, interviewing people, trying to find out what's actually gone here, interviewing people at school, interviewing family. So there's a lot of people starting to come in and be involved in this inquiry. And a lot of interest as well, being a young girl, small rural community. There's a lot of things there that heighten people's interests, I think.
Yeah, we might come back to that because it was a really. I was in Wellington at the time, and it was front page every day, of course.
Yeah.
You were quite early on in the piece asking for sightings of a beige or fawn-coloured Lada sedan.
Yeah.
In the area, what was going on there?
So one of the things you do in these inquiries is try to track movements. As a lot of this information is starting to come in and locals are being interviewed, people at the school, there's a heck of a lot of information coming in. You are trying to firm up on sightings. And, for example, by that time we'd spoken to Stephen and had an idea where he might have been. We were trying to get information from the community if they'd seen his vehicle, seen where he might have been, but not just to the exclusion of him, that we were trying to get information about a lot of other things as well. So even though Stephen was sort of parked almost off to the side in some respects, and that was my little area, there was a massive inquiry going on, also looking at all other options, so to speak.
So did you learn anything interesting from him when you were interviewing him about what he did that day?
Yeah, well, it was interesting because it was only 10 or 11 days between the inquiry starting and him being arrested, which is quite a short time in lots of respects. And what I did learn, and I look, you know, and I didn't think about this a lot at the time, but looking back, methamphetamine was definitely around, but it wasn't something that necessarily I'd had a lot of experience with. It was an up-and-coming drug, and yeah, we'd all heard about it, and I'd had a bit of time in the drug squad and so forth. But the effects on behaviour, I think, was one of the... he was one of the first people that I really got an insight into the manic behaviour from someone who had, you know, had a meth problem.
Yeah.
And
You were aware that he was taking meth?
Yes, and I must say, initially, you know, people had been talking about it and saying, oh, you know, he's been... he's involved in methamphetamine. But it was really that time from the hospital and speaking with him that I saw that manic behaviour, and it was really extreme. And I know it was a shock to myself and both Nick Lane, who was my partner at the time. We were both, like, quite amazed at that manic behaviour that he'd displayed. And, of course, later on we realised that he'd been running around and using methamphetamine and hadn't been asleep for, you know, 2 or 3 days, and a whole lot of other factors which made sense of that. But definitely was a wake-up, that's for sure.
So at some point you'd have the idea of talking to his mother, or did she come to you?
Yes, well, you know, trying to make sense of all this, like I've explained to you, in a very short time, and trying to find a way to deal with this, you've got to be pretty agile in your thinking and your approach. How are you going to do this? Because we have a few curveballs. Suddenly we've got a person of interest at this stage who is later to become, you know, the key main suspect, who's now in custody because he appeared in court and on that matter, which was unrelated to any of this inquiry. So that was difficult again. But very early on, his mother had made... I'd got to meet his mother at the hospital. I actually gave her a lift up to the Masterton Hospital on day two, and I was having a chat to her then, and that was really very, very interesting. And she was a lady that had definitely was lady of the world, and was incredibly interesting to listen to, and very, very helpful, very down to earth, but she knew her way around the world, that's for sure. And we got on really well, and I remember thinking, oh, God, you know, this is the mother of this guy, and she's very, very helpful. It was quite strange, but anyway, I did, yeah. I spent a lot of time talking to Robin Williams every day over the next 10 or 11 days, that's for sure.
If you just tuned in, by the way, I'm talking to John Galter, who was a detective sergeant in the Coral Ellen Burrows case, and we're talking about how he managed to identify Stephen Williams, Coral's stepfather, Coral Ellen's stepfather, as the killer, and how that sort of transpired. So she eventually said something to you that was pretty helpful, John?
Yeah, it was a... At the time, a lot of the things that Nick and I probably did at the time were more instinctive, but in reflection, were, thank God we did. They were quite strategic. We had good relationships with Stephen's mother, with Robin, and we also had a reasonably good relationship with Stephen. I mean, even though a lot of people say, oh, he must have been a suspect from the get-go, well, he was a person of interest, and this goes back to... You can't close your mind off and say, oh, he's the man, he's in the frame. And we didn't do that. We had built a relationship with him, and we wanted to find out actually what went on and whether he was key to this or not. It was still up in the air. It wasn't definitely not set in concrete. So in retrospect, that was crucial to finding Coral. So I often look back and think, you know, thank God we did what we did. because it worked out right in the end. And a lot of that was, you know, treating people with respect and being empathetic, even if we have our own perceptions or biases or whatever, which we've all got, but you have to park up. That was one of many lessons I learnt, is always make sure that don't close your mind off too early. Be very clear about what you're trying to do and how you treat people. And, you know, roll on 10 days' time, it was Stephen Williams who asked if he could speak to me to tell me that he'd committed the murder.
So, tell us about that. How did you get that message?
Well, he was in custody, of course. So he was in Ruamataka prison. And so I wasn't able to communicate with him, but I'd been dealing with his mum, and his mother was giving me a lot of the background to Stephen's life and her own life, and a lot of really, really interesting but crucial stuff to know, in addition to the fact that we were doing this little part with Stephen and Robin Williams and so forth, but there was also a massive big search going on, all the other inquiries. So there was, it was a huge deal, but we were sort of in our own little bubble dealing with the Williams family, so to speak. So Robin had been talking to Stephen a lot and saying that she'd been talking to myself and Nick, and obviously during this time when he was in custody there was a lot of time for him to dwell on what had occurred. I was starting to get a fairly solid feeling that there was something wasn't quite right here, and as the inquiry was going along, it was little things were popping up which were indicating that Stephen's just more than a person of interest. You know, he was a suspect. It was about day 10, he was talking to his mother, and he said, "I think I need to speak to John Golder." So he did. And I jumped in the car thinking, wow, okay, and went down and went over to Upper Hutt when we got an order and he was released from Ruamataka prison, and I interviewed him at the Upper Hutt police station. And that was the first of many interviews. So I think it was about 7 or 8 o'clock at night, I interviewed him. His mother came over as well. He admitted to what he had done, and that's when we jumped in the car and I asked him if he would show me where Coral was. And that's pretty much how that went.
Yeah.
You know, and of course, it's an amazing feeling when someone says, "Could I speak to John Golder, please?" I was like, I'm pretty happy about that because I must say I was absolutely relaxed about it. I knew that he was going to, I knew that he was going to tell me that what he had done. I just...
Well, on your way there, you knew?
Yeah, I just, even when Robin Williams said to me, "Oh, Stephen wants to talk to you," I absolutely, 99% in my head, I thought he's going to admit to this.
Why do you think he admitted to it and didn't keep his mouth shut and try and get away with it?
Well, I think guilt. Absolutely. I think getting stuck away in prison, I think that overwhelming realisation about what he had actually done, bearing in mind that the relationship between Stephen and Coral, as I understood it, was actually a good one. It wasn't like they didn't like each other. From all accounts, they had a great relationship. So I think the horror of coming to the realisation of actually what he had done was an overriding factor in why he thought, oh, my God, you know, I'm going to admit to this.
So also, tell me...
There's a few other things, too, yeah. I think, that that played into this, was that there was a lot of media interest at the time, you know, a lot of a media intensity, and he knew that the whole country basically had zoned in on him. And the smartest thing, I think, that we'd done is not been part of that. We'd been non-judgmental, and it was one of the things he did say, because I said to him, I said, "Why did you..." He said, "Well, I knew the whole country hated me, but you weren't judgmental." And I remember him saying that, and I'm thinking, wow, another lesson learnt. And I suppose when I look back, and years later, I was speaking to other detectives about interviewing in bits and pieces, it was one of the key things is to hang on to trying to be non-judgmental, despite what you may be thinking, because you could be the person that they go to tell.
Do you remember the drive to find the body?
Yes, I do. Yeah, I mean, that was the drive over the hill was the night of the first interview, so it was, you know, probably day 10 of this inquiry, and I remember really, really, really wanting to find Coral's body. It was a very, very intense because, yeah, it's one thing to find the person who has committed the murder, and there's another part to getting the body. And, you know, it was a tough area over there. It's a massive area. And the search area, as it transpired, was a long way away from where she was eventually found. So I remember the drive from Upper Hutt over there, and my biggest fear the whole time was that Stephen was going to come to this realisation of what he had done and clam up or just go, no, I'm not going to show you, or I'm not going to tell you where the body was. That was my biggest fear, to be honest. And I must say, I remember that very, very clearly because it was a very intense trip and it was dark and really windy, and we had to go down to the bottom, way down the bottom end of the Wairarapa, you know, the bottom of the North Island. And it was so dark, and he was trying to describe where he had put her, and of course, it was hopeless. Down there, there's no light. It was all looked the same, and in the end, we got a local farmer and described to him what had been described to us, and he said, oh, I know where that is, and jumped in his tractor or his truck, I can't remember which, and drove us out there, and we eventually got out there, and Stephen Williams said, that's where she is there. It was just the absolute middle of nowhere. And it was very late, about 11 o'clock at night, I think. A couple of guys went over with torches and eventually found her. That was a huge relief, massive relief. There's one thing I do remember about the inquiry was the relief I felt at that moment.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there were subsequent interviews with Stephen Williams past that where we obtained more of the story and exactly what had occurred, and we found some other clothing and other evidence. But once we had the body and I knew that, you know, he was the offender, there was huge relief, that's for sure. I think it was huge relief for everyone.
And was it pretty straightforward from there through the trial and to his conviction?
Well, you know, the interviews were done really well. We got everything we possibly could, and Stephen pleaded guilty, so there was no trial. It was mid-December of 2003, he pleaded guilty to the murder, and I think got 15 years, sentenced to 15 years, and the Crown appealed it, and he ended up getting sentenced to 17 years in prison, so he's due to be released, or was due to be released on 2021.
For those of us who remember that case, it's incredible, really, to even think about the idea of him being released.
Yeah.
However, recently, I'm sure you saw that story as well, he was sentenced again for attempted murder on an inmate.
Yeah. And to me, no surprise, to be honest. You know, Stephen is, I remember back then, there's a lot of complexities to that character, and I don't really think Stephen ever wants to get out of prison. You know, for a number of reasons. So, you know, I wasn't totally surprised when I saw that, to be honest.
In fact, was that his second?
I think so.
Attempted murder in
prison? Yeah, I think so. I can't remember just off the top of my head, but
2017 and again in 2019.
Yeah. So, yeah, there's no will to get out of there, that's for sure. So I think it's preventative detention now.
What about the Coral Allen's family? Did you probably guess how they were doing during the her mum and her dad during the investigation? But what can you tell us about them?
Well, you know, Jesse, I didn't have a lot to do with the family. It was almost like we were in our own little bubble dealing with Stephen and Robin and the interviews and so forth. But of course, there's Ron and Gemma Cremin. They are the parents. Yeah, I mean, what can you say? It's the, as a parent, it's your worst nightmare. And I don't know how you ever come to terms with something like that. It was as horrible at the time as you can imagine for Ron and Jenna Kremen. I mean, it's horrible. Horrible for the whole community, but, you know, as their family, it was just wrecked. And the younger brother, the older brother, Storm, who's, you know, 20, probably 24 or 25 now, as well, losing his sister. So, yeah, terrible.
Was it one of the biggest cases of your career?
Look, I suppose it was. You know, I didn't sort of view it like that. It was just how it all unravelled. I've been on other murder inquiries and serious crimes and, you know, other cases that are equally as horrific, to be honest. But, of course, this one sticks in my mind, and I didn't really have much to do with post this inquiry. I just sort of carried on, and I think I went off to music school and I came back to the police, and it wasn't until about, you know, 4 or 5 years later, I think, was at the police college, that I started reflecting on what actually occurred in this inquiry and using some of that, because there was some really good stuff done there. And it was one of a number of cases, but of course it had such high profile for, you know, for a number of reasons. I think there have been a lot of murders in the Wairarapa over the years, and of course that fed into this too, that here I am, you know, 20 years later, and it's still a feature in people's minds. But yeah, I mean, police work is full of horrible and intriguing cases, but of which this was one. But yeah, definitely it's probably been one of the more high profile ones that stuck around.
You've been listening to Crimes NZ with me, Jesse Mulligan. You can find more episodes on the RNZ website, or we're on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, iHeartRadio, or wherever you find your podcasts. And once you've finished binging this series, you might like to try Untold Pacific History or the New Zealand Wars series for your regular history fix.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.